we know that as soon as such a community would be lost, learning, in the sense of philosophy, would become an academic affair. That philosophy could not go on freely anymore in the streets and with everybody. That students had to be trained. In a free community, there was this possibility of poets, philosophers, and scientists working in and with all citizens of Athens who cared. They didn't have to exclude anybody. From then on, they had a situation Socrates didn't care for either, because he wasn't born into it. From Socrates to Plato seems to be a leap of 100 years instead of a few. Instead of 2 or 3 decades, of almost 200 years historically. The situation after Socrates' death had completely changed. That we must know in order to understand what Plato was up against when he had to interpret this man. Now, he did it most cleverly. He made Socrates the Greek hero, the tragic Greek hero. Plato was a dramatist. And in all his dialogues, most of them, Socrates is a main figure that helps us to see him as a living man. Though Plato has to put in the mouth of Socrates many ideas, and especially the theory of ideas, which Socrates never dreamt of, as Aristotle rightly says, and which can mislead us. Nevertheless, the man he shows, and he shows the consistency of his deeds and his thoughts, he shows it permanently. And we can win out of his papers, his dialogues, the vision of the great hero of the age we are talking about, namely the age of the self-discovery of men. Socrates becomes this hero because he loses the last illusion that all those thinkers we have considered up to now still had, knowing it or not knowing it. Namely, that a certain certainty could be gained if one comes out of the framework of myths. Socrates is the first man who takes consciously upon himself the fundamental uncertainty of existence in which man has to live, which he has to accept if he wants to be free and creative. He is the first who realizes this terrible predicament of man, that the gods, being ironical, have set at the price for the freedom of man absolute courage. When Socrates talks about the virtues of man, and Plato talks about them, and we can always find discrepancies, we can always find contradictions in the dialogues, and by them we find out what Socrates meant and what Plato meant. When Plato talks, courage does not play the decisive role. The decisive role plays goodness. When Socrates talks, courage plays the decisive role. And we have always thought, and I think most of us still think it, the interpretations have all gone that way, that this Athenian Socrates, who was himself such a good warrior, being old-fashioned compared to Plato, being conditioned by his elder time, of course still felt compelled to put the old Greek virtue of courage first. And so we have overlooked that he didn't mean this courage. He meant absolute courage. He meant that man must face his inability to know that he does not know, namely that he does not know and cannot know the ultimate answers to the ultimate questions. And if he is in a predicament where he cannot do that and does not want to escape into the next best belief or superstition or theory or for that matter metaphysical system, that then he will have to take it upon himself to live in this and with this basic uncertainty till he dies. If he is ready to do so, then the free creative capabilities of men are his. If not, the gods will smile ironical and will mislead him, because Socrates thinks that the gods mislead men by religion, by established religion. That is what the dialogue Euthyphro means. Here Plato confronts Socrates with a priest. He is accused, going to be accused of impiety. So in his ironical matter, because he copies the gods in that way, he is himself ironical and he thinks human beings should be ironical. He catches this man. You must know, you are a priest, you must know what piety is. And he asks, and it turns out that he doesn't have the slightest idea. Socrates, who always pretends that he does not know what piety is, and who really believes that he does not know it, or knows that he does not know it, he, in the run of the dialogue, makes it more and more clear to us that men who do not know what piety is, who do not have that part of the absolute truth sure in their hand, that those men have a big chance. Namely, they can do pious deeds, as Socrates does, and they can avoid impious deeds, because this man who believes that he knows what piety is going to accuse his own father of murder, which is a strange impious act, and Socrates always takes him up on that. This dialogue, because it is so simple, can serve as a model for the real Socratic method. Not what is usually called the Socratic method, which is the Platonic method. Namely, to pretend that one does not know and then ask other people's question, never utters one's own opinion, and tries to be superior over them. That was not Socrates' method. Socrates' method was a mixture of practical thinking and highest theory. And that is his irony. He tries to find a way which has only a direction. The direction towards truth. And he finds that this direction can best be found if we do not pretend that we know what truth or reason or everything else for this matter might be. But we have to pursue it constantly. The main contradiction in the dialogues is that sometimes Plato seems to say that virtues can be taught, and sometimes he seems to say they cannot be taught. Now let's first find out what Plato really means. for himself. If we read the Republic and read the study, the metaphysical theory of eternal ideas as it has been worked out by Plato, and consider his definition, for instance, of art as saying art is to participate in beauty, making beauty an absolute, that if I want to participate in something, that means I must be able to know it. If I must be able to know it, it must be possible to teach it. And Plato really thinks in the end that Socrates was a man, he might have believed that, because he was after all only a student, so he was a genius. He could have misunderstood him too. Partly he wanted to misunderstand him. Partly he might really have misunderstood him. He tries to show us that Socrates, being so ironical, always leads his listeners in many dialogues finally to the conviction that virtues cannot be taught, because the sophists pretend they can be taught and even ask money for teaching them. But that Socrates, being ironical, has an afterthought, namely that he, Socrates, is the one who can teach them. And that therefore Plato must also be able to teach them as a follower of Socrates. That is a misunderstanding that contains a great understanding. Socrates did not think that virtues can be taught, and he thought that virtues can be taught. Both. Namely, by finding that they cannot be taught. That means that we cannot know what the definite virtues, which for him are the principles of wisdom, or the overall is his absolute wisdom, or truth. The principles of it, namely beauty, justice, courage, judgment, freedom, they cannot be taught. And yet, they can be practiced. By practicing them, without teaching them, they grow. And that is the way the human mind, which is only human for Socrates, has no divine quality whatsoever. He follows Heraclitus strictly. He makes the absolute distinction between the absolute mind and the human mind. Plato already, who can be interpreted as a Neoplatonist, will interpret him later, blurs this distinction. If we can participate in the eternal ideas, which are, so to speak, the truth itself, or God, then we have something divine in us. That means we might also have an immortal soul. Socrates does not know if he has an immortal soul, and he doesn't say anything about it, because he is not convinced that our mind is not only is convinced that our mind is only a human mind. He sets us apart from the gods or the divine, even sharper than Heraclitus does, by his interpretation of the Delphian oracle. The Delphian oracle is a mystical thing and one of the most amazing ever invented. It has, as Greek myth everywhere, a slight content of reason before reason is ever practiced. No wonder that the Greeks are the ones that established philosophy, because their myth was already a little bit more philosophical than any other myth, and it was also a little bit more ironical. The irony of Socrates is really a quality of the Greek gods, of the gods of Greek myth. And Socrates knows that very well and manifests it in his practice, because he knew that this irony means the great skepsis, makes possible the great skepsis that every human being needs. We have a saying in Zen Buddhism that runs, when there is much faith, then there is enough skepsis. When there is enough skepsis, then this makes inquiry possible. If inquiry becomes possible, parts of the truth might be reached. This is an almost Socratian saying, because Socrates had faith. We do not know if he had faith in divinity. He might very well have had. But he had certainly philosophical faith, the faith that Heraclitus had, namely the faith that being has a meaning and that man can join this meaning. That is philosophical faith. If philosophical faith is broken as well as religious faith, then of course we have nihilism. But he was far from that. He had at least philosophical faith, and that he had absolutely. He might have had religious faith. He might have drawn the conclusion of Heraclitus that if that is so, then there must be a divine being that put meaning into being. But we do not know exactly about his position towards that. He was very careful about it and very skeptical and philosophical. But this skepsis he used, and skepsis is the child of irony in the sense he understood it. Now the Delphian oracle is ironic. It is the most ironic invention of myths that people who come to a temple, the temple of Delphi, in order to ask Apollo, the god of wisdom and art, questions, that they, when they go into the temple, overlook the inscription of the temple, which is "Know thyself." They can, in a way, go into the temple and ask silly questions only if they overlook that inscription. But they should then not mind, if they have gone into the temple that way, that they will be fooled. And they were mostly fooled by Apollo, because he had set a condition, "Know thyself," that should make everybody turn on his heels, go back home, and start thinking first, namely thinking what it means that this is inscribed there. The only man who ever did that was Socrates. He didn't even go to the temple. He never set foot there. But one of his more eager students, who became so convinced